Good evening. So I wanted to just begin by not telling you the generation I grew up in, although that's written here, but telling you how great you're all doing. You know, we have this very special privilege of being able to see you and to hear what's coming up and how you're working with it. And, you know, this practice is just, it's quite amazing, actually. And, you know, we go through a lot. When Jeff goes away on retreat, I go through a lot. It's like we're all going through a lot. And coming and sitting quietly together, stuff just unties itself. I mean, it doesn't just untie itself. A lot of difficult stuff has to be faced. And there's struggle and there's concern. Nothing's happening. Too much is happening. But I really believe, and this is what I'm going to talk a lot about tonight, I think, that we are untying deep knots that are in our hearts, that are in our bellies, that are in our heads. And as we untie these knots for ourselves, we're doing it also for the benefit of all beings. It's not only just for us. We sort of clamp in on it like it's just for us. But it's for all beings everywhere. So a few weeks ago, Jeff asked me how I was going to frame my talk for this retreat. I was given the task of talking about Tikkun Olam and social justice. That's the reading for this month, November. And I said to him, you know, probably I'll just say what I think is true, which is that doing things to help others makes us feel good. So, you know, I think that's basically true, that doing things for other people, we feel good, we feel right, maybe more than good, when we act for the benefit of others. Living our lives in such a way that we help to create the conditions of justice that can help to care for the well-being of others makes us feel right, straight, and in alignment. I think Lisa used those words yesterday, in alignment. And, you know, we all know this because everybody in this room, in one way or another, is some kind of Jewish helper in the world. You know, so this is something we all, somewhere deep inside of us, know. One of the things that we're doing on this retreat, and one of the things I think we do with this kind of practice, is learn how to recognize this alignment, this rightness. We learn how to recognize it in our bellies, in our hearts, and in our minds. When the attention is settled, when the heart is open, we feel connected and we feel well. And this very blessing practice trains us in the alignment and in the recognizing of the alignment. It allows purification to happen. It allows things to line up. You know, sometimes it's a windy path to get there. Sometimes we don't even recognize that we're getting there. But slowly and surely, we get aligned. So I think Lisa talked yesterday about these four levels, which I'm going to make reference to in the talk a lot. Personal. I don't know if I understand these levels exactly the way she meant them, so I'll just tell you how I took them. But like the deep work that we do inside of ourselves, the personal work. The interpersonal work, which happens maybe in that dyad, in that relationship. The institutional work that happens in our communities. And then the cultural work that has to do with the isms, she said, racism, classism, sexism. And I don't know if those are fractals. Maybe those are fractals. I don't know. But those are the interfaces. I think when Jeff was talking about interfaces yesterday, he was talking about places where we interface. And there is something that happens in that I-thou relationship, and we can interface personally, interpersonally, institutionally, or culturally. So I was talking to somebody today. It was quite a wonderful conversation. And she was talking about, because today we moved on to loved ones. And one of the reasons I decided to say that we were all doing so good was because there was so much stuff coming up with loved ones. And so she was talking about her relationship with her mother. And I said that, you know, probably anybody here would have something to say about their relationship with their mother, right? And maybe your mother was this way or that way. But when we do the work of feeling, really feeling whatever it is we feel, the sadness, the grief, the loss, the joy, we're not only doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for all of us because we all have one form of or another of that knot with our mother. And so the deep work that we do inside, because the mother-child relationship is an archetypal relationship, I really believe untying those knots for ourselves reverberates out in the world. They're not only our knots. They're the primordial knots. However, we're the only ones who can untie ours. We have this very unique, specific opportunity to do our work. And no one else can do it. Sheila, in her talk, referred to the fundamental unity of being. And I think this is an aspect of the fundamental unity of being. So that's why I say the work that we're doing here, we're not only doing for our benefit, we're doing it for the benefit of all beings. And it's a mystery, right? It's a deep, deep mystery. How does that happen? I don't know how that happens. We don't know how that happens. But I think it's part of the fundamental unity of being. I also think that working for the well-being of others is perhaps one of the deepest expressions of what it is to be human. It touches on something so deep inside of us. As Jeff was saying yesterday, maybe being in an active listening and present relationship heals some kind of rift. It moves us into Gadlut in some way. You know, it allows us to open, expand, to do it for the benefit of others, and it touches something so deep in us. And there is a mystery to it, right? One of the things that I want to remind us about is the mystery, because the mystery challenges us in a kind of way not to know, not to be in such control, but to have faith, to trust, to challenge our fears. So this is a quote from Buber. And Buber is citing what I've come to learn, I didn't really know this, is something called the Golden Rule, which is V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. And Fox translates that in the two Levitical passages is be loving to your neighbor. Be loving to your neighbor. I like that. Be loving to him. Be loving to her. So this is a Buber quote. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am the eternal. There is a Hasidic interpretation of the last word of this verse. I am the eternal. You think that I am far away from you, but in your love for your neighbor, you will find me. Not in his love for you, but in your love for him. The one who loves brings God and the world together. So this is the place that I'm really interested in. This is where I find my great inspiration. For me, encountering that space where we encounter the other is a place of discovering a new face of God. So I let's see how I want to explain this. There is, you know, in the encounter with somebody, Jeff was talking about in this relationship, I'm sure it's related to the parts of him what I'm talking about somehow. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure the parts of him come alive somehow in what I'm going to say. So in the relationship, there is this I-thou relationship, and there's this space. And in that space, God comes in. It's in the space where we are no longer two individuals, but something else has been created. But when we challenge ourselves to encounter something that's difficult in an I-thou relationship, something that we fear, something that we wouldn't normally do because, you know, we've walled ourselves off from it, in that space, we encounter a new face of God. It's not the same face. That's my experience. So I was thinking about this, and I was trying to give an example. And I have lots of examples because I work in a prison where I, you know, face all sorts of stuff. But I decided to go to a different example, which is that my first year of rabbinical school, I was invited. I spoke very good German. I was a German major, German and religion major in college. I had studied German in high school, which was a whole, like, thing, you know? Like, I grew up in a pretty traditional environment, and everybody was a little concerned why I studied so much German. But my grandparents spoke German together. That's why I studied German, and I had family that lived in Eastern Europe, and it was my common language with them, and I wanted to speak to them. But I was also in a, I was in a PhD program at Temple in my first year of rabbinical school, and I was invited, along with Zalman, to and some other people from RC to take part in Jewish-Christian dialogue in East Germany in honor of the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther. It was like what I had been aiming towards in my encountering the other for all the years of my study of German, really. I mean, I studied German because I wanted to read Thomas Mann in German, and I studied, socialist theological responses to the National Socialist Movement. But then I had this opportunity to go to East Germany and sit with theological students who were my age. I mean, I think I was 24 our first year of rabbinical school. And it was at the height of the Cold War. And, you know, they were a satellite of Russia. And we were talking about Jewish-Christian dialogue. And there weren't any Jews, obviously, except for those of us who came to do it, right? And it was such a powerful encounter with something that was so not, you know, I mean, I grew up in a, my grandmother said the only good German was a dead German, right? You know, I mean, I lost a lot of my family. And a whole new encounter, a whole new relationship, a whole new God expression, I felt, came into being in my life, or was really crystallized. And so I think that when we challenge ourselves to face the places that we're scared of, places where there's illness, places where there's depression, places where there's hurt, places where there's suffering, places where there's strangeness. And it can be very, very simple. I remember working, I did a training program like this many, many years ago, and there was a beautiful woman who lived like in Petaluma, in Northern California. And she was challenging herself to go work teaching meditation in some area of some city near Petaluma that scared her. It scared her to be there at night. She was going for an evening class and she was really frightened. And I, you know, just let it, pushing herself to make that encounter, I think is what brings God into the world and a new face of God. So one of the things that I want to challenge us with tonight is for each of us to think about what is it that inspires you in that way? What is it that challenges you in that way? And I think that when we touch that place, then that challenge that Lisa brought to us, that the Aboriginal woman said about, if you're here for your freedom as well as my freedom, then come and join me. So what is that cutting edge of your freedom? Maybe you have an answer, maybe you don't have an answer. Maybe that's one of the things you're going to contemplate. So in this practice, we sit down, we've been sitting for the past 2 days. Our hearts might be settled, our hearts might be in disarray. They may be soft and open. They may be closed, angry, whatever it is, bored. Pay attention, because our practice this week is about purifying our hearts so that we can connect with the truth that's inside of us, and the truth of what we have to do, the truth of how we have to be in the world. So I don't know, some years ago, many years ago, 8, 9, 10 years ago, I used to sit many 2-week retreats a year at the Forest Refuge. And I was sitting a 2-week retreat, and there was a woman who had been at the Forest Refuge for a year. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it. And she was leaving while I was there. It was like an awesome thing, you know. Her community had sent her to sit for a year. And she wrote a little thing on the board that about on the day that she left about the sure heart's release, about what happens to the heart when we are in touch with our own natural goodness and our connection to all of life, and how our hearts release and we are able to show up, to be present. And I was so, just that line, the sure heart's release. What we're doing here is practicing being sure and allowing our hearts to release. From a theological perspective, I would say that when the heart releases, we are able to recognize God. God is always present, but we're not. So we're cultivating our ability to be in the God field. So getting back to this golden rule, v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, we should be loving to our neighbor. One of the things that I think that's really important to stress about it is that it is a universal religious value. It's not only the Jews. You know, everybody, all religions really, really believe and teach that it is an intrinsic necessary part of a spiritual path. The second thing that everybody teaches is that there has to be a path that brings us back to recognizing that truth. The blessing practice is such a path. So, you know, I was working with V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, we should be loving to our neighbor, and I get all these things on my computer from all these different places, and I just, you know, like gratefulness.org and, you know, Jewish Currents, and it's amazing how many times in the course of the past 10 days, something about caring for the stranger in our midst, whether it was a Native American or it was Indian or whatever it was, came across my screen. So I saved some of them, but I don't have time to tell you all of them because this is a Jewish training program, so I'm going to tell you the Jewish ones. Last week, we began reading Genesis again. And I started reading the Parsha. Genesis 4, 9, and 10 are the lines after Cain kills Hevel. And God says, to Cain, "Where is Hevel, your brother?" And Cain says, "I don't know. Am I the watcher of my brother?" So the Torah doesn't answer that question directly. It leaves it up to us. And, you know, to a certain extent, I think that's the question we're asking ourselves all the time. Am I my brother's watcher? Am I my sister's watcher? And this is one of those archetypes. So I'm sure, I know I spoke to somebody today or yesterday who talked about their relationship with their sister. You know, I have three siblings. These knots that we have in our relationships are primordial knots. And how we work on, how we ponder the question, am I my brother or sister's keeper, watcher, on the personal level, on the interpersonal level, on the institutional level, on the cultural level, has tremendous significance. And it doesn't matter where we enter in, because as we touch those places, it is part of the unity of everything. So I had the great fortune, good fortune, not easy, of being in therapy with my three siblings over the past year. And how often do we reflect on that our relationships with our siblings are not only our relationships with our siblings, right? They're all of our relationships with our siblings. And we're all about this question and all about this task. So from a place of commitment and a place of love, not always pleasant, we challenge ourselves to face those difficulties so that we can untie those knots, and so we can confront a new face of God, a face that isn't always pleasant. So about this verse, you know, I went to my usual sort of progressive Hasidic sources to find out what they were saying about this, and nobody said anything about it, which I thought was interesting. I'm sure there's some reason, but then I went to my Jewish learning, very good resource, and AJWS had something about it, the American Jewish World Service, about this question, where is Hevel, your brother? So they say that the Parsha goes on. After that, there's this lineage that happens between Avraham and Noach. And they bring up this midrash, which is a discussion between Akiva and Ben Azai. And Akiva says that v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, loving your neighbor, is the most important rule. And Ben Azai says, no. This lineage that is in Bereishit, that comes after this, where we see the lineage, is more important than V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, because it underscores the depth and breadth of humanity, our responsibility to one another, even more powerful than the golden rule. We are a single family of humanity. So then the text goes on to say, now, he said, God said, what have you done? A sound, your brother's blood cries out to me from the soil. So the voices of our brothers and sisters from the four corners of the earth actually does cry out to us all the time. But for most of us, it's too much to hear. You know, it's incredibly painful. And part of what this process is about shedding layers so we can hear these voices and have a sense of stability while we hear them. The reason we don't hear them is because it's too painful, right? So we learn how to be steady. I'm going to talk more about this in a few moments. The practice is really about learning how to be steady, to hear the voices and to turn towards them. The voices in ourselves, the voices of the people we love, the voices of the institutions, and the larger voices. So today I wanted to mention this because I think this is part of this question of how do we plug in. I got an email from a woman I know in Woodstock who told me that today there were marches in over 30 cities in the country to stand in solidarity with the people of Ferguson in opposition to the racism and police brutality in this country. So that's a way that we hear the voices, you know? And I thought to myself, well, I couldn't be there, but we could be here in solidarity. So all of our traditions, our tradition and all other traditions have this ethic of caring for others. And all of our traditions have histories that have preferenced triumphalism over that caring. And Sheila spoke really eloquently about how the greed and the hatred and the delusion is born out of our fear and misconception. And our religious communities are also, responsible for acting in terrible ways. So I'm not sure if this really fits here, but I think it's an important point. So I was talking to someone today, and I think maybe how I thought it fit here was that, you know, this piece about our religious communities continuing to behave in ways that are hateful, despite our deep commitment to peace, right? It's very confounding. It's very confusing. It's very confusing for us to know how to respond to that. And Sheila said, because we still believe that hatred can end hatred, which I think we learn on the cushion is not true. And we also believe that greed can satisfy us. And I think when we practice with discipline, we learn that that's not true too. But this was the piece I wasn't sure I would fit in. Somebody said to me today that they were surprised at how difficult some of the practice was, that it was still difficult, as though we think we're going to get to the end of this. Because we do. I mean, part of me lives with the delusion that if I do it good enough, I won't suffer. But, and the suffering shifts and I become more balanced and we keep doing it. At least most of us do. Maybe some people get somewhere different, but that's not my experience. And so then the question becomes, well, is what I'm doing enough? Is it enough? And, you know, Sheila's teaching about Yirah today was so wonderful, because within Yirah is the fear and the awesomeness, all wrapped up in one. And so it's never enough, and we can only do as much as we can do. Both are true. And what Jordan said the other day, we're planting seeds. That's what we're doing. And it's a mystery. It's just a mystery. So the second thing I was talking about was how we need to have a path for ourselves. The thing, you know, I read the Parsha every week in a maximum security women's prison with my women. And it's so great, right? I mean, especially you can imagine the first Parsha, right? or, you know, the first, our ancestors, one of the first terrible things that happens is a murder, right? And I find that reading the text really gives me comfort in understanding how complex and difficult it is to be a human being in this world and how precarious it is. It is so precarious. And so we read the text, I read the text as an affirmation, like, it's really hard, you know. The life of Moses is such an example. Or for us in prison, the fact that Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son, because most of the women I work with sacrifice their children in the face of their crimes. So there's this deep way in which the text allows us to confront our humanity and how fragile it is. And we also get an insight into the divine human journey and the covenant and the wrestle that that it is, and the wrestle with God, which is not a clear thing at all. It's this constant discernment. But we need a path. We need a path, or else we get completely lost. So I don't know if you, I think on the curriculum there was stuff from the Noble Eightfold Path by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Is that true? Is that in our curriculum? No. It's a great book. But we have, traditionally we have a halakha, which really means a path to walk. And for most of us today, the traditional halakha is not accessible and is not pertinent. I don't know if that's the right word, but whatever. Most of us are not halachic Jews, and we don't follow it, and we have reasons. But I think we all need to have a halakha. We all need to have a path that we commit ourselves to, that in some ways takes precedence over, you know, our moods, mind states, and desires. And the halicha that I have takes into consideration a practice. It has to have a practice that helps me to see clearly, that helps me with greed, hatred, and delusion, that reminds me how to get back on. But the most important thing for me with that is good friends. Good friends. And that's what this community is. This is a community of people who are struggling to come into alignment together. That's a really important piece. I think also being committed to work with the stranger in our midst, however you do that, whenever you do that, is really important. It's a gemilut chesed practice. It's, you know, it can be Torah, Avoda, and Gemilut Chesed, a wisdom practice. It works, right? It really works. It's a wisdom practice, a concentration practice, and a service practice. This is a challenge for all of us. Jeff and I are in continual discussion about how to tighten up our practice. And it changes, you know, it changes as we get older, it changes as our children change, it changes because of the circumstances of life, and we may need to do a little more of this and a little more of that. So that's one of the things that I hope that this training program is going to help you, help all of us figure out, is how to refine the way we walk in the world by committing ourselves to things that are not so easy, not so natural, because that again reverberates in all those four realms and touches the unity of being in ways we don't know. So the this week's parsha is the Rainbow Covenant. So this is Fox's translation. When I becloud the earth with clouds, and in the cloud the bow is seen, I will call to mind my covenant that is between me and you and all living beings, all flesh. Never again shall the waters become a deluge to bring all flesh to ruin. So I think that this relates to our shalom practice. It relates to the practice of equanimity that we're cultivating. I'm not sure shalom and equanimity are exactly the same, but it's how I'm working with them. So that's also something for you to contemplate or to be with. I was having a conversation with one of you, and she was saying to me, what we're doing in this practice is cultivating equanimity. And I really agree with her, actually. It's a big part of my practice in the moment. And equanimity, I described it yesterday or whenever it was that I gave instructions. Equanimity is our capacity to stay present regardless of what's happening. So on the cushion, it's very clear that we are cultivating an awareness. We're cultivating the ability to watch things come into the field of attention and things go out of the field of attention. Most often we notice that we've fallen into whatever it is that's coming into our field. That, you know, a thought comes in, we buy into the thought, and then we realize, oh, I have to return, right? That's our tshuva practice. I have to return to the breath, to the body, to the blessing practice, whatever it is. But we're aiming the practice at being able to watch things come into our field and go out and be like a mountain and sit and not go after something and not push something away. To just be with the truth of how something is. And I think this is a practice of peace. It's about creating a deep, abiding capacity to be at peace. Now, I say that, and, you know, my Jewish stuff comes out like, whoa, you know, because this isn't only on the cushion. It's in life, too, right? We're practicing it on the cushion so that we can be with the forces in our lives. Like, this is such a great translation. When I becloud the earth with clouds, our minds are beclouded, the earth is beclouded, everything is beclouded. You know, part of me says, you have to respond. Well, you do have to respond. It's not that we don't respond, but we also have to learn how to be still so that we're not crazy. Because otherwise we do, I mean, I get crazy. I have to learn how to have a sense of composure and a sense of peace because things happen that I have no control over. I don't control my mind. I don't control whether or not we go to war. There are things that I can do and there are things that I have to respond to, but this is a practice of peace. It's a restraint practice. It's a practice of learning how not to react, seeing how we react to things that grab our attention and we go with them. Just like Sheila said, that we believe that our desires will satisfy us. Things come into the field of attention, we watch them go out, we restrain ourselves so we can see how impermanent they are. And it's a practice of non-harming. Non-harming because, well, the non-harming, Miriam's yoga class today was such a great teaching on non-harming. Miriam talking about, I was very moved by her saying about her surgery 6 months ago and dancing this weekend. And can we just be with how our bodies are and not need to layer on like, oh, shouldn't I be able to do it this way? Or shouldn't just like, this body has been through a lot. This body has, God willing, a long time to go through. And can we just not hock it? Just let it be. And that's true on the cushion, too. This is all in the service of coming into alignment, lining ourselves up with what's deeply right and deeply true for us. I wanted to say something very little, actually, about Simcha. So the first time I heard Sylvia give a public talk, she said that what brings us to meditation practice is a desire to be happy. And I spent years and years and years and years working with that. And maybe the last retreat I'll give a talk on happiness. But in part, I think that that's true. This gets back to the question yesterday about getting in touch with our aspiration to be happy. But I'm going to defer talking about happiness. I'm going to point you all to Sheila's meditation on the ashray, which is actually in the reading for next month in this booklet that we have, this beautiful booklet that Sheila wrote about deep spiritual practice and social activism that is part of our reading. And in there is this meditation on the ashray. And it's really a meditation on what happiness is, as far as I'm concerned. I loved it. And actually, I'm going to read it tomorrow to all of us for the ashray. So Sylvia said, you know, we do this to be happy. There's what to say about that. But one of the things, I think we do this practice to heal ourselves. We are all on a journey of healing. And my dear friend, our dear friend, all many of our dear friends, Mordechai Liebling, was at a conference before the Climate March in New York at Union Theological Seminary. And he met with a lot of indigenous leaders who were there for the climate march because climate change affects indigenous people in the worst possible ways. And he heard this thing that said, by one of somebody who was there, who was from an indigenous community, said, "I learned more from my healing than my thinking." Right? I learned more from my healing than my thinking. And that's what we're doing here. We're healing. And we're learning from our bellies and our hearts and our heads all together. That's what we're doing here. And it requires discipline and it requires practice. So I have a lot of quotes about that, but I'm not going to do them. It really, really requires discipline. So, Miriam Scharf asked this question yesterday about my instruction about getting in touch with our own aspiration for happiness. And, I remember I referenced that I had been in this, training program years ago. It was a Buddhist training program, and we were in Southern California at a retreat center. It was also many retreats over 2 years. And it was my first time I ever met a monk, a Buddhist monk. And actually, we're doing some of his reading this next month on self, non-self, self and non-self, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, Tanjef. And in one of the sessions that he taught, he said, "The question really is how serious you are about your happiness." And it was really like, it was like laser sharp. And I think it relates to this question about our aspiration for happiness, because as we do this practice, our aspiration grows exponentially. And our understanding of what freedom, I don't know about happiness, what freedom is, it becomes richer and deeper, and it becomes clear to us that it functions on all those levels, the personal, the interpersonal, the cultural, the institutional. And our journey of being in touch with our own aspiration for freedom is completely linked to the aspiration of all other beings for freedom. So we don't just do it for ourselves. So I want to just read one more thing. So one of those sayings, I wanted to talk a little bit about rachamim, because I was hitting shalom, simcha, rachamim. But I'm not really going to talk about rachamim. What I'm going to say is one of those things that came across my screen this week, October 13th, was Thich Nhat Hanh. And it said, "We are here to awaken from our illusion of separateness," which is a beautiful thing, and I think is also about V'ahavta L'recha Kamocha. But I was also doing some studying with some friends, and I came across this thing by Thich Nhat Hanh that I think is completely delightful. I just loved it. And it is about waking up from the delusion of suffering. And I wanted to leave us with something delightful, because I started with how well you are all doing. And that is really just delightful. It's really, it's inspiring. It's beautiful. It has tremendous power. It's a gift to me. It's a gift to all of us. So I'm going to read this thing by Thich Nhat Hanh, which I think is great. "The first time I tasted peanut butter cookies, I was at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center in California, and I loved them. I learned that to make peanut butter cookies, you mix the ingredients to prepare the batter, and then you put each cookie onto a cookie sheet using a spoon. I imagined that the moment each cookie leaves the bowl of dough and is placed onto the tray, it begins to think of itself as separate. You, the creator of the cookies, know better, and you have a lot of compassion for them. You know that they are originally all one, and that even now the happiness of each cookie is still the happiness of all the other cookies, but they have developed discriminative perception, and suddenly they set up barriers between themselves. When you put them in the oven, they begin to talk to each other. 'Get out of my way. I want to be in the middle. I am brown and beautiful, and you are ugly. Can you please spread a little in that direction?' We have that tendency to behave this way also, and it causes us a lot of suffering. If we know how to touch our non-discriminating mind, our happiness and the happiness of others will increase manifold." So let's just sit for a minute.